Welcome to the third day of Rohatsu Sesshin, the periods of Zazen arise and cease like waves on the ocean. The days roll by, and yet in the ocean of now, it's exactly the same as that first period of Zazen. It's the same now as the last period of Zazen. Everything that has ever happened is happening now, and it will ever happen. It's all taking place in the boundless, inconceivable ocean of here and now. So we might as well appreciate it, because this is all we've ever got. This sesshin, we're taking up and looking at Keizan Zenji's Zazen Yojinki. Keizan, the fourth ancestor in Japan, after Dogen Zenji established Zen in Japan about 50 years later, when Zen was quite flourishing already. 50 years after arriving in Japan, Keizan and other ancestors at this time felt the task was now that it's established to clarify Zen in the new land. So Keizan wrote this treatise based or inspired by Dogen's instructions for Zazen, and he kind of expands on that and gets into some more detail, called the Zazen Yojinki. Yojin is literally like using the mind, yo and jin, but as a compound it means like guidelines or cautions for Zazen. So how to use the mind in Zazen, or guidelines for Zazen treatise, the Zazen Yojinki. And we finished yesterday with this section that goes, Zazen is going right into the ocean of awareness, the ocean of Buddha nature, manifesting the essence of all Buddhas. The natural luminosity of mind suddenly reveals itself, and the one original light shines everywhere. There is no increase or decrease in the ocean, and yet the waves never stop rolling. There's no increase or decrease in the ocean of here and now. How could there be? Because now, this now includes all of time and past, present and future, and this here includes all locations throughout space. So this all-inclusive here and now never increases or decreases, but the moments, like waves, arise and cease, and the locations seem to move through our experience of here and now. Keizan continues with a direct quote from chapter 2 of the Lotus Sutra about the one great matter. The one great matter. Ichidaiji is the here and now. Ocean of awakening. So for the Buddha's one great matter's causal condition, for the Buddha's the one great matter's causal condition is appearing in the world to teach people the wisdom and insight of awakening and give them true entry. This phrase, the one great matter's causal condition, is became a favorite phrase for some reason in the Zen tradition. So like at the bottom of our blood lineage document, that when you receive the precepts, you receive this Kechi Myaku, at the bottom it says, for the Zen tradition, the Bodhisattva precepts are the one great matter's causal condition. So it's referring to the Lotus Sutra, but the original sutra says the one great matter's causal condition is the Buddha's appearing in the world to teach people wisdom and insight of awakening and give them true entry. Keizan says, for this there is the peaceful, pure practice of Zazen. This is the complete practice of the self-fulfilling samadhi of all Buddhas, Jijiyu Zamai, which we chant at noon service in this sesshin. So again, he's referencing Dogen. This is the sovereign of all samadhis. Zamai, O Zamai. Zamai, O Zamai, O Zamai, O. Is the name of an essay by Dogen. The samadhi that is the sovereign or king of all samadhis. Peaceful abiding in this samadhi. Samadhi is unity, right? Is the samadhi is being one with the ocean of here and now. Peacefully abiding in this samadhi, the mind ground is illumined at once. So this phrase keeps appearing throughout this essay, illuminating or clarifying the ground of mind. Or this translator interpreted that as the ground of all experience, the ground or the source from which everything arises. So Zazen is illuminating the ground of all experience. Zazen is illuminating or clarifying, opening and clarifying and illuminating the inconceivable ground, which has many names, like the ocean of here and now. You should know that this is the true gate to the way of the Buddhas. That's referring to Dogen's Bendowa, where he says, people asking, well, there's all these different practices. Why are you so hung up on Zazen, Dogen? Someone asks him. And Dogen says, because it's the true gate. Or like the it's the entry gate and the true gate to Buddha's awakening. If you want to open and illuminate the mind ground, give up your jumble of limited knowledge and interpretation. Cut off thoughts of worldly dharma and Buddha dharma. Abandon all delusive feelings. When the true mind of reality manifests, the clouds of delusion dissipate and the moon of the mind shines brightly. The mind moon, of course, is always shining brightly, but often in Santa Cruz, there's this thick fog, so sometimes it's just like a faint glow through the mist. It's hard to open and clarify this ground of mind, but when the clouds part and dissipate, then the mind moon seems to shine brightly. It was always shining brightly, but now we get to actually enjoy the full bright moon. So the clouds here is a jumble of limited knowledge and interpretation, and you know, thoughts about the past and future that seem to be somehow outside of the ocean of here and now. They're not really, right? This ocean is all-inclusive. Nothing can, not a drop can leave this ocean. But it seems to. And as soon as anything seems to leave the ocean of here and now, we don't appreciate it anymore. Or as much. All kinds of trouble begins when the slightest particle moves outside of the ocean of here, seems to move outside of the ocean of here and now. I think the problems come because nothing can move out of it. So if we think it does, then that's just already, that's the beginning of confusion. The Buddha said, quote, listening and thinking about it are like being outside the gate. Zazen is like coming home and sitting at ease. Unquote. And Keizan says, how true this is! Exclamation point. There's traditionally these three kinds of wisdom. The wisdom from listening, shuddhamaya prajna. The wisdom from listening to Dharma teachings and reading Dharma teachings. It's a kind of wisdom. It's conceptual, right? Our conceptual mind receives it. And then the second is the wisdom from thinking about the Dharma, chintamayi prajna, so using the conceptual mind to assess what we've heard or read. I think really important, we can't just hear the words and be like, oh, okay, I guess that's so. We have to reflect on it and check it out for ourselves, as Buddha says. In our conceptual mind, does this actually make sense? That's clarify it conceptually. And then the third type of wisdom is bhavanamayi prajna, the wisdom of cultivation or practice or literally becoming. Bhava means like to become this wisdom. So this is the non-conceptual being of the teaching. So we can hear like we are all currently resting in the ocean of here and now. We can hear these words as some wisdom comes from listening. Then we can reflect on them. Well, what about yesterday? Koku says yesterday is part of the ocean of here and now. And we're like, how does that make sense? We reflect on it conceptually and then clarify more and more. And then in Zazen, we actually become the ocean of here and now in a non-conceptual way. We don't. But the conceptual ideas help us, hopefully, they help us enter the ocean directly. Otherwise, Dharma teaching is just kind of entertainment at its best. So Buddha says, listening and thinking about it, these two types of wisdom, they're good, but they're a little bit like being outside the gate. Or another translation says, shut out by the door. And Zazen, or Bhavanamayi Prajna, the wisdom of being, is like coming home and sitting at ease. So we might say, well then why does he keep writing and why does Kokyo keep talking? Because we have a lot of more time in the day to do Zazen. So hopefully our listening and thinking time can be encouragement to enter the gate the rest of the day. And it might be like, well, if we really like don't ever want to be outside the gate, I think that's fine too. So while we're listening and the mind is moving, interpreting and so on, we can also be this ocean. Like hear these words as like waves crashing on the shore and receding back into the ocean, and then another sentence comes as another crashing wave and recedes back into the ocean. You can listen in this way. Maybe the content doesn't even matter so much from the point of view of the ocean. You don't need to let the words I don't need to let the words shut us outside the gate. Keizan goes on. Listening and thinking about it, views have not yet ceased, and the mind ground is obstructed or congested. The mind ground sometimes has congestion. And this is why it's like being shut out by a door or outside the gate. True sitting puts all things to rest and yet penetrates everywhere. This sitting is like coming home and sitting at ease. And then Keizan now brings up a whole section of Dogen's writing, the Hokyoki. Dogen's conversations with his teacher Ru Jing in China. He says, being afflicted by the five obstructions or the five hindrances arises from basic ignorance, and ignorance arises from not understanding your own nature. So this is a conversation about the five hindrances, which is a nice teaching to remember in Sesshin. Do you know the five hindrances? There are Nivarana. Not sure. We'll try.
Greed, sloth, torpor.
That's kind of one. Sloth and torpor, yeah. That's sometimes a kind of klesha affliction, but this particular list of five hindrances doesn't include that one. These are particularly, what? Gao, yeah.
Desire.
I think she said, yeah, greed and desire are like the same.
Nervous energy.
Yeah, nervous energy or restlessness and worry. And, basic, like, delusion is the last fifth. Confusion is like, maybe craving or sense desire. By the way, these are, you could say, they might be hindrances to Buddha mind or something, but they're usually taught as, particularly as hindrances to meditative concentration or stability or to samadhi. So that's what this list is particularly about. So things like pride is also could be a hindrance to the full awakening of a Buddha. But these are like, when we're trying to just sit in the present, that's why it's a great Sashin teaching to review these five. We're just trying to sit at ease in our home of here and now. And these five hindrances are, maybe we could even say the only thing that prevents that. So if we take care of these five, we are then sitting at home. And the five are sense desire, this is five senses, so we could be like wishing for like lunch or I think desire also includes aversion. Aversion is another name for desiring a different experience than this one. Right? So in that way, aversion and desire are just like two sides of the same coin. So when there's the, I was talking with someone about sounds yesterday, and sounds sometimes have almost like their own sort of personality, different vehicles, maybe we unconsciously or semi-consciously associate them with conceptual ideas about even fossil fuel being burnt and the explosion of fossil fuels is what we're actually making the sound, right? And I said, for me, the one that really like has a particular flavor, personality, is these like motorcycles with, you know, intentionally bad mufflers, where they're trying to like, and you can tell they're like shifting gears really fast and going really fast. Ring, ring, and it's like, it's not like it's not helpful for the mood of zazen. So that could be this first hindrance. When I hear that sound and there's like a little bit of like sense desire for a slightly different sound, that desire, or we could call it aversion, prevents my just resting in the ocean of here and now, doesn't it? And it doesn't have to. Right? We can hear that same motorcycle as just, you know, waves in the ocean, sound waves rolling along through the ocean of now. So that's the first is, and I think the biggest, you know, we think of sense desire as like wanting some blissful feeling or something, but I think that just anything having to do with the physical senses. So I think the dominant one for us in Sashin is the physical body sense, right? We desire a more comfortable body, sensation often, right? And this often will prevent us from settling deeply into here and now. So this we all get to work with this one in Sesshin by really just not trying to move away from it at all, just settling into the physical sensation as it is in the ocean. Just this tingling knee or feeling of tension or contraction, whatever it is. When we become one with the sensation, that's like samadhi. Right? Or if we separate ourself, some imaginary me that's having the sensation, we separate that me from the sensation, now we have a relationship with the sensation, and that relationship will prevent it. We have to dissolve the relationship so there's no me and sensation, there's just being the sensation. Like I am nothing other than this experience. So that's the first hindrance. The second is anger or aversion. So maybe it is the flip side of sense desire. It's the resistant side to what's happening, and maybe particular anger towards people, or even being annoyed at others, which of course will happen in the Sesshin when we're all trying to do all this stuff together in silence. Little things, we just like, they're chanting too fast, too slow, too loud, too soft, too high, too low, too something. So, again, it's just what's happening. And we're released from that hindrance. It's just waves on the ocean. And these waves are made of ocean. The ocean of now. So those are like the two kind of grossest ones. And they're like kind of a pair of like the wanting something more, pulling it in, and wanting something less, pushing it away. That movement. So these are the things we can notice in our eyes. I'm really not settled. This is a nice checklist to remember. And I'm not into it. It's not going well. I'm not here now. Well, pull out the checklist of the five hindrances. Really, it's a great practice because it's like you go through this checklist, and if you notice it, then you can, okay, I can work with this. And you go through all and they become workable. Really, that's all there is. I think if these five are like pacified, we are present. So the next two are like a little bit subtler pair, also a kind of a pair. If craving and anger or aversion are a kind of pair, the subtler pair, once we take care of those, that we get to work with are this sloth and torpor, which is maybe a slight kind of aversion, actually, and restlessness and worry. But you can see how those are kind of an opposites too, right? Sloth and torpor is everything, and Kazon's later going to get into details about these, but sloth and torpor is everything sinking, and there's no energy, and it's just like sleepiness is taken over. And sometimes we really need sleep, but sometimes it's just like resistance or even like boredom. Maybe we could call this like I just don't have the energy to fully abide in the ocean of here and now. It's kind of an energetic thing to really vividly be here now, right? And like, enough of that. I've been doing it for a couple days already. Let's just take a little rest. It's especially after your meals. so that when we can watch, and sometimes we really just need to take a rest in Sesshin, we can't. we can a little bit, but so we have to find ways to work with it in Zazen too, right? And one little trick one of my teachers has offered with this that is kind of counterintuitive, I think, but I found it works, is when you're feeling this sloth, torpor, hindrance, to which is a state of actually like being very, very relaxed. That's the kind of nice part about it, but it's being a little too relaxed. But this teaching, this secret teaching, is to relax even more. Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive. Like, my approach to this before I heard that was like, when I'm feeling that kind of like, sit up straighter and like open the eyes and like, you know, kind of like wait and bring some energy, make more effort, right? And sometimes that works too, you know, gently, kindly, just, okay, sometimes it's like sit up straight is it just a kind of a nice one. But sometimes it's this opposite of like, relax even more deeply. And I think that the reason this might work is because I think sometimes sloth and torpor is a state of kind of like a subtle resistance to what's happening. Like we're making a subtle effort to resist, but it's taking the form of just sort of checking out. And by relaxing even deeper, we maybe actually enjoy presence even more. Because I think it's part of samadhi, like settling into presence it's an enjoyable thing, and we have to really be enjoying the present. And this sleepy dullness can be a kind of resistance to the present. So, okay, maybe I'm still making a little effort to resist. Well, how about relax even more? Just like, oh, okay, just like whatever, but in a positive spirit of like, not like a defeated whatever, but like whatever, just here. But maybe like a little breeze of energy arises. So you can try this out if this one comes to you. And then restlessness and worry is the opposite. That's the sloth and torpor is the sinking, restlessness and worry is like this rising up of too much energy. And I like that, how it's sometimes put as restlessness and worry. So worry is this like sort of an agitation of mind about the future, and so which takes us out of the ocean of now. Gear Tenzo. And the last one, and in a way maybe the most subtle, this fifth one, hindrance, is doubt. Because I think we can, that's why it's nice to kind of go through in this order, I think. First we take care of like grosser craving for a different body sensation or aversion to this body sensation. Then okay, I'll accept this body sensation. I totally accept it. now that I've accepted it, I start to relax. Okay, relax even more. Just and sit up straight. Okay. Then this little thought of like, oh, did I turn off the lights at home? If I did or didn't at this point, it doesn't matter. And so then all those are settled, and now we're sitting, and then this little bit of doubt. And I think that I think doubt usually refers to like, it's more like a spiritual doubt. It's not so much doubt about whether I turn the lights off. This is doubt about like the practice. It's like, it could take the form of like, is this really worthwhile to sit here for 7 days like this? I mean, there's so many things in this world that need doing. Is this really worth it? That's it undermines our presence, right? Or I'm not sure if I'm doing it quite right. I know I've got like endless zazen instructions, but they're so strange. And we're talking about zazen is, you know, it's not like reading a manual for how to put together a chair or something, right? It's a little more subtle. So maybe it's close to right, but maybe I'm not, it's not quite right. That kind of doubt. Which is, and they say the antidote for that one is to clarify the teachings, actually. For me, one of my personal big hindrances, well, is all of them. but especially, I think over the years, doubt has been a big one for me. And I think it's because I have a very active conceptual mind. Some of you might have noticed. It's a blessing and a curse. The curse of the active conceptual mind is even the slightest doubt about how the practice works or the Dharma becomes like almost like an obsession. Like I can't totally settle until I clarify it. That's why I'm constantly like studying Dharma. Because it gets settled and then some new question comes up, right? How does it integrate with this other teaching? And I find that it really does work to study the Dharma more and more deeply. Does resolve doubts just in a conceptual way. And resolving those doubts helps to be able to then really, okay, I got it now, let's do it. So, yes.
Well, it sounds like just treating the doubts as waves in the ocean doesn't work.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think actually, the more we trust the ocean, I have received this teaching myself when I brought up this, how to work with doubt, one teaching I have received, is exactly that. See how this doubt is waves in the ocean. Yeah. So I think, but we have to have a certain, degree of trust in doubt-free trust in the teaching of the ocean of here and now, in which everything that's appearing is waves on it. The more, if we really trust that, then we see doubt about maybe some tangential point. And then we see, oh, I see how that's arising from this storehouse of possibilities in order to kind of like prevent me from just like entering the ocean. Yeah, kind of very subtle resistance for, particularly for conceptual people. Yes.
I remember the first few years of doing session, doubt about my capacity was extremely strong.
Oh, yeah.
So much doubt about the teacher, just relentless doubt. Can I do this? I'm not good enough.
Yes.
And something that felt very good about doing long sessions is it just burned itself out.
Yeah. In fact, long sessions are good for all these hindrances, and that's why, I think it's Shohaku Okamura or his teacher Uchiyama Roshi says, usually in Japan that they carry a stick during zazen, and if you're sleepy, they'll just hit you. And he said, but in that lineage, and our lineage too, we don't carry the stick. And the way that they explained it was like, well, if you sit long enough, you'll eventually wake up. You could be like sleepy for, you know, days, but like after a few days, you'll get bored of sleeping. So, but I think your other have a nice point too about that is a type of doubt, is just like self-doubt, kind of more like a personal doubt of like, I've clarified all the teachings, I can see how they work, but I don't know if I can do it. Yeah, so this one I also is healed and calm through just continuing. And also the for example, the teaching of the ocean of here and now, and that everything arising is waves, that type of teaching is not like some big thing that like is hard to attain. You know, it's kind of just describing something very, very simple. So, and sometimes we're all just present. And, I mean, even to think, even to have the thought like, I really just can't be here now. Even to think that thought, if we kind of catch ourselves, starts to seem a little bit silly, right? Because we know we are here now, right? It's not something we have to get to. So it's more just like, we know that we are here now, and it's just and we know we can trust ourselves that sometimes we're willing to just be here now. And we all know that too. So, yes.
I found the first sessions I did just super dramatic, and maybe it's opening up that storehouse consciousness in a way that is unique. Maybe the first couple of times,
mm-hmm.
I was like, "Oh my God, whoa!" kind of visions and hallucinations and drama. I'm not to project for me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's, yeah.
Really kind of extreme. And maybe other people have a situation of having met themselves in other contexts, but it feels like, oh, this is a really new context.
Mm.
And that kind of deep meaning.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, opening up the storehouse. Or it's like getting to know ourselves really, really intimately, and just like, you know, like layers and layers, and we're going like further and further. So there's stuff in the busyness of our daily life that we maybe have little hints of, but we don't, it's not like in our face because we keep ourselves busy. So, yeah, I think that's, in Sesshin, we, in the non-busyness, these deeper layers of ourself, meaning like our conditioned tendencies, reveal themselves more and more. So it's, I think Sesshin is quite humbling. It has its whole range, right? But I find most longer Sesshins, there's times of great humility, like, wow, like, I'm really a mess. After practicing a long time, this mind is, like, out of control. And, of course, then other times where we really get to enjoy sitting at home in our true self. So, yeah, we get run through the ringer. Yes.
I don't know if this question just made me wonder, what percentage of the time, conventional time, in Zazen, when you say you are actively turning the light around and looking in, and what percentage of the time not?
Wow. Bring it out. Make him confess. Yeah, well, I would say, the percentage of time turning the light around is not enough. Yeah. It's interesting watching days go by too, because there's like phases. We get to, in a longer sitting, like in one day, it's like I almost don't really notice phases so much, but as with different days have different characters, I think, and some days it works really well, and some days it seems like more of a struggle. And it's not necessarily like chronological, like the later days are better. So I think it also gets, I think as Sesshin goes on, some subtlety is revealed about the difference between turning the light around and not turning the light around also. So that's why it's hard to put a true number on it, actually, a percentage number, because if it's like maybe at the beginning of Sesshin, it seems like it's very black and white. This is like turning the light of awareness around, and this is not. Right? It's like, and it's, this is the practice, and this is not. And like, I'm going to do the practice, and I'm not going to not do the practice. Right? It's, I don't know if other people have that experience, and when we start retreat, like I find I have a, it's a more kind of rigid mind of like, this is it, and this is not. And as the time goes on and days go by, it's like the distinction gets much more blurred. So you can like, for example, in this session I've noticed there's times when I'm really attending to body sensations, and there can be quite a lot of tension in the body, almost like whether it's chi blocked, or whether it's conceptual stuff, unease that's conscious or unconscious that contracts something. And I've noticed that the body can even hold quite a bit of tension at the same time as like really being kind of in touch with this larger space of the ocean of here and now. And also the turning the light around and attending to awareness itself, being aware of being aware, is we could call like the inward facing path, where it's just that's the dominant foreground experience, is this inconceivable, ungraspable ocean of awareness. And there's still stuff happening in the background. And then there's like almost like not much. We're really attending to the space of knowing presence. And then there's the outer-facing awareness that's, we kind of shift the ratio based on the inward-facing awareness. We shift back out, and we're really attending to the objects of experience. But instead of being like really separate objects now, that we're living with them as the display of awareness. They are the vivid manifestation of this ocean, but we're really focusing on them, on the waves of experience. And the ocean, it's this ungraspable, unseeable ocean, is kind of in the background, and yet we know that that's the source of all this stuff. So, but we might not be really in touch with like the space of awareness as a kind of empty space. We're really engaged with the stuff, but there is this kind of thread of knowing that all of this is held in the space, where it's all the display. And so, so in that case, that would be an example of, it's hard to define then, in that case, is that turning the light around or not? Not exactly. It's not the inward-facing awareness specific practice, and yet it's informed by that, and it is enlivened by that, and loosened up by that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the Krishas and opening up to the idea of like, oh, it's okay because I'm just a mess. It's really helpful in Zazen, and I know a lot of conversations about Zazen. As he was practicing, seeing that guilt and that mess is just one of the waves in that ocean can help alleviate it. But then when we walk out of Zazen, how do we bring that into our life and still maintain level of leadership, whether it's being a parent or a boss or a teacher? How do
you accept the mess, but then also provide without falling apart,
provide some direction?
Yeah, part of it is working with guilt is forgiveness, self-forgiveness, which mostly seems to come from the understanding more deeply where all this stuff is coming from. That all of these waves of our past, our ancient twisted karma for which we feel guilty for, and the guilt itself, and all our relationships with other people, and all of that is all these waves, right? And all of that stuff is waves that arise and cease dependent on conditions. So we could say in this metaphor, the conditions are like other waves, especially as the waves approach the shore, right? It's like this mass of waves, and each wave is affecting another wave, and they're all moving. We can't even figure it out, but we know that every wave arises not spontaneously due to its own free will or something, but it only arises due to the other waves moving around, and so that everything we've ever done is arising due to these conditions, which also arose due to conditions, which also arose due to conditions with other people and other people and other time and other space and other things and other thoughts and the whole storehouse of conditioned tendencies sometimes creates this wave of yelling at someone, and we see when we're more settled, we see, oh, that had to happen like that. I do feel sorry in a human way. I regret that, and I didn't need. I feel like I didn't need to do that, but in fact, it had to happen according to conditions. So, whatever, I can forgive the whole process, and I can forgive others, too, for yelling at me, because they had to. You see how they had to? Right? There's no alternative to that event. Now, the next event is now informed by my remembering that event. Remembering that event is now a wave for the next event, so probably in the next time it will be slightly different. So that's a kind of, that's a kind of dharmic forgiveness of ourselves and others when we see how the waves arise and cease. We can't blame any particular wave, including our so-called self. And we see that the nature of each of these waves is just the ocean water of the inconceivable here and now, all-inclusive, all that we all share. That's one thing about the ocean of here and now is it's what we share most intimately, right? All of us. You could say, even if you have a really intimate relationship with some person, you say, well, really, we share these things most intimately. Actually, oh, it's not really those things. What we share with that person most intimately is the ocean of here and now. And we actually share that equally intimately with, like, the little ant walking down the sidewalk, and with all of us, and with the sun and moon and stars, right? So if we remember that ocean, and then also the waves that we're all being turned around by and turning others around with, are beautiful waves, beautiful stormy white caps. Does that address the question? When you were saying too, like, yeah, I can see in Zazen, and like, but what about after Zazen? Another thought when you said that was, well, the Zazen that Dogen and Keizan are speaking of is not a matter of sitting or lying down or walking or sitting in the Zendo. It's the kind of Zazen that, you know, potentially would be, is just, Zazen is going right into the ocean of awareness. So that one is always with us, whether we're notice it or not. So this section about the five hindrances here is that Keizan's quoting from Dogen, who's quoting his teacher Ru Jing, the lineage of this teaching here. Being afflicted by the five hindrances arises from basic ignorance. And we could say, let's say for now, basic ignorance is forgetting the ocean of here and now. From not understanding your own nature, your self nature. Zazen is clarifying or illuminating the self. Capital S self is another name for this ocean. Even if you were to eliminate the five hindrances, if you haven't eliminated basic ignorance, you've not yet realized yourself as the Buddha's and ancestors. Ignorance, as I said some previous day, is avidya, like not knowing, or Japanese way of saying it is mumyo, which means like no illumination. If you want to release basic ignorance or non-illumination, the essential key is to sit Zazen and wholeheartedly practice the way. Zazen Bendo. And just to finish this piece here, this is the Hokyoki that Keizan's quoting from, Dogen talking with his teacher. So Ru Jing says just what you just heard about this basic ignorance and how that's the root of the five hindrances. And then Dogen says, records, I bowed with gratitude and said, I've never heard this teaching before. A lot of my brother monks don't seem to talk about this. I think this may be pointed about this basic ignorance being the root. It must be that I have good roots from the past that enable me to hear this today from you, your compassionate teaching. So I love Dogen's spirit of devotion. He hears these, it's not that big a deal to hear that, right? But for him it's like, this is so amazing that I get to hear this Dharma. It's a great spirit, right? But teacher, please tell me further, what is the secret of being free from all these five hindrances and the sixth hindrance of basic ignorance? Tell me the secret now. And Ru Jing smiled and replied, haven't you been practicing all along? What you've already been doing is exactly the way to be free from these hindrances. Buddhas and ancestors don't wait for people to go through various stages. They just directly and personally transmit the way to be free from these six hindrances. And that way is the practice of just sitting, dropping off body and mind. There's no other way, and there's no point in talking about any other way. I'm just going to finish the page. An old master said, when confusion ceases, calmness arises. When calmness arises, wisdom appears. When wisdom appears, reality displays itself. Page one. Yes, Don, did you?
This question of taking our practice outside of the seminar, I think within our practice itself, daily Zazen, at the end of it we have a ritual cleaning, and then a ritual cleaning, period. And a good function there is to clean with the mind that you were just in, with Zazen. And during the session, we'll all experience it once again at 1:30.
The work period.
The work period. Mm-hmm. It's a little different than ritual cleaning, but it's basically Zen strategy for helping people to take the practice out of the Zendo into the world.
Nice point, yes. The work period of Samu during Sesshin is not just because we need to get things done, but it's an opportunity to put the practice into motion and silence, or it's not completely silent, but mostly silent. Trying to keep that spirit really helps to do that. Yeah.
And just as we have Dai Sesshin, which is the big Sesshin, we have Dai Samu. And I've heard it said, actually, that we continue to work until we can reliably verify that someone has died in the process.
And I think it's a gringo, it's the Dai Soji. Is that around when you were there, Rachel? Did they do Dai Soji? Dai Soji is like a cleaning. Soji means cleaning, literally. So I think maybe once every few months at Green Gulch we'd have Dai Soji for like 3 hours and like try to clean up the mess.
Also,
do you remember that, Liz? Dai Soji, yeah.
In other schools, they have what's called the cleaning gym, which is the day that the session, it's actually the day before the session will start. But you have one practice, and then you have the cleaning of the lots to do before the session. Mm-hmm. But you have cleaning, and then like a 3-hour rest period where you
rest.
Sleep. But, you're supposed to basically put your own affairs in order. Wash your clothes, whatever you do.
Sesshin, it takes a lot to set it up and tear it down.
Well, the students are allowed to do you know, for their free period, more or less, it's cleaning day, and they're supposed to do one thing, but they can do anything. But the monks fall on them to really get things, you know, the nameplates set up and the cushions and all that.
And now, since we're in the middle of Sesshin, the work is all done, and we can just enjoy the ocean. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.